This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The AIDS epidemic has made it necessary for friends to care for dying friends. R.S. Jones' new novel, Walking on Air, asks the questions, how much can you ask of a friend when you're sick? And if you're healthy, how much should you be expected to sacrifice for a dying friend? The novel is about Henry, who totally rearranges his life to care for his dying friend, William, who has no family to care for him. William doesn't believe he can completely trust his friend Henry to remain with him. Other friends have already begun to abandon him. William has started to keep score in his head of the number of phone calls he receives each day, and the number is dwindling. Here's a short reading.
The sicker he became, the more William worried that there was a mystery to blood ties he had never understood that transcended the love any friend could offer. He knew many people who had abandoned their lovers, their apartments, everything they had become, at the last possible moment, and gone home to their families to die, as if the life they'd led in the interim had only been a game. He had heard countless times that even the aged called out for their mothers in the throes of death, as if from first to last the mother was the one irreplaceable thing. As a boy, William remembered pricking his finger with his best friend Hugh. Blood brothers, they would say, as they watched the droplets merge, as if to render the bond of friendship something deeper than it could ever be on its own, as if a brother would be more vigilant, more loyal, than a friend could ever be. William didn't know if he questioned Henry's faithfulness because he doubted his own, or if he had forfeited a security in leaving home, some natural acceptance of duty, which made family relationships more enduring than those a person could ever have with his friends. "You are my family," William said over and over to everyone he knew, repeating the phrase to himself when he dared not say it aloud, as if he could bewitch his friends into believing it was true.
Robert, how did you start thinking of what it would be like to die without anyone who had the blood connection, the responsibility that seems to come along with blood to take care of you?
Well, the germ of the idea of the book came from someone I knew, who was estranged from his family and, in fact, was so difficult in terms of day-to-day life that he had no friends, and I lived in his house. And
you lived in his house?
I rented an apartment in his house in the basement. And although we were not friends, as he got sicker and sicker, there was nowhere for him to go. And so you begin to think a lot, and so many people I know who have been sick, who while they're in their life in the city here, the friends come and go at the hospital, but then usually at the end, when they need more constant care, most people end up going home to their family, which is sort of interesting to me. Number one, why one's family is ultimately the one that takes one back. And in terms of one's friends who have their own lives, and there's really no, as much as you think that they're the sort of foundation of your daily life, often there isn't enough room in their lives to take care of someone in the sort of 24-hour a day when someone's in crisis.
So you lived in the basement of this person who was dying. What was your responsibility to him when he was sick?
Well, I don't know that there's a sense in which I didn't really have one, and yet since there was no one else that he knew, I found myself going to the hospital 3 times a day to visit him when he was there and bringing him the newspaper and things and dealing with the doctors. But it was a sort of fake relationship in a sense. It's sort of, you know, like if you're walking down the street and pass an accident and don't stop to help. But ultimately, he did end up going home to his family who he hadn't spoken to in 25 years because there was no one else to take him. At the time, the hospital, you know, his beds got smaller and fewer and fewer. Even though someone was dying, if they weren't in, there was nothing that they could treat. They had to give up the bed, so there was nowhere else for him to go. So it's sort of ironic that one ends up, in many cases, back at home, anyway, even if it's the last place in the world that you want to be.
Of course, your main character, William, does not end up back at home. He is permanently estranged from his family.
Well, yes, and he actually has an actual relationship with his friends, as opposed to, in effect, a tenant, which was the germ of the idea from where I started writing from.
William, the man who is sick in your novel, is very aware of the imposition that his illness is on his friends, and he hesitates to call friends. You write, he grew accustomed to the catch in their voices as they waited for him to state what he needed, as if he had no other purpose than to ruin their days with his emergencies. A lot of this book is really about where that line is between what is asking too much of a friend.
I don't know what the answer is. It is sort of one of my obsessions. Even in the first book, Force of Gravity, there, Emmett at one point, Emmett's different. He's not dying. He's just crazy or crippled with anxiety. But he refers to, although unnamed, a poet who had alienated all of his friends. And when he finally died, it was in a flea bag motel in Times Square, and it took 3 days for someone to interview, to identify the body. I mean, that I vaguely meant to be Delmore Schwartz, which sort of fascinated me how someone who lived within a world and had a certain reputation could so wear everyone down that by the end there was no one left, and they wouldn't, they didn't even know that he was dead. So I think that there are, despite our best intentions, sort of limits to what anyone can tolerate in terms of the thing about somebody who's dying is that it's incredibly boring, aside from being terrifying and all of the rest, and it never goes away. And day after day, they're on the phone, and there's a crisis and something to do, and they're not interested in the rest of life, nor I think should they be necessarily, but their world consists of the sort of 3 feet beyond their bed. So, but I think someone who, and William isn't particularly self-transcending in the best of times, but even he within the book is, as his greatest fear is to be alone when he dies, tries to temper some of his demands to try and keep his friends around, which of course then leads to his trying to hook Henry by promising to leave him his house and his will. So in effect, trying to buy loyalty with the promise of some material reward.
You say that you're obsessed with deciding if there's a line between what's asking, what's appropriate and what's asking too much of a friend when you're sick. Have you been on the side of being asked to do more than you thought was reasonable?
That's not the part of the trouble. I mean, I probably have been on the side of being asked to do more than is reasonable, but that doesn't bother me so much. I've been on the other side when I've been asking or have asked people to do more than I think is reasonable, and that troubles me much more. I mean, sort of, I myself am more willing to put up with that sort of trouble than inflict it on somebody else, but still to maintain some sort of civility in one's, I mean, I think one of William's problems is the great fear of death and the disintegrating body around him and all the things that are happening to him is, he says at one point he decided that he could only express his true terror only once to each friend, so that he sort of parcels out his future slowly. Because if every day when someone comes, you sort of scream and cry and say, I'm terrified, you'd have to be some sort of Mother Teresa to keep coming back for more.
So you've been the person who was in need, feeling like you were imposing on friends, asking them to do things for you. What was your situation? What was your condition?
Well, I don't know if it was the condition, but there's a sense of what, you know. There was a period many years ago when I was more like Emmett in Force of Gravity, certainly, than I am now, in terms of trying to deal with acute anxiety. And so I put a lot of... I took up a lot of some of my dearest friends' time, who are still my friends, but... After a certain point, you just have to pull yourself together. As someone once said to me on the phone when I called, this is 15 years ago at least, in the middle of the day, no, I can't listen to this right now, I have work to do. And it was bracing in a way that was transformative, I think.
My guest is R.S. Jones, author of the new novel, Walking on Air. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Robert Jones, who writes under the name R.S. Jones. His new novel is called Walking on Air. Your new novel opens with the main character thinking, his body terrifies him. His body is a bomb. His mind, he knows, his body terrifies him. From what I've read about you, there was a period of your life when you were at war with your body. There was a period of a couple of years, I think, when you were anorexic. And your previous novel, Force of Gravity, is about someone who is anxious to the point of being mentally ill for a while, and one of his symptoms is that he recoils at the sight and smell of food and won't eat anything but raw carrots. When you were kind of at war with your body and not eating... Was it about being thin? Was it about looking a certain way for, you know, was that the way you thought you'd be most attractive, or was it about something else altogether?
For me, it was the sort of weird eating habits that became more and more out of control had to do with trying to achieve some state of purity, however misguided. And... So I kept cutting more and more things out so that by the end I was only drinking carbonated water. That part of the book is true. And I think it's a way of retreating from, or in my case anyway, retreating from the world into some sort of shell. And then so the shell, which is the body, gets smaller and smaller, and somehow it feels easier to live within.
Had you ever been heavy in self-consciousness about being over self-conscious about being overweight?
Well, it's I'm rail thin for the most part. Although one finds as one turns 40 that parts of one's fat doesn't go away like it did at 25. Food is I don't know. My brother became a chef, and I became anorexic. So
That's funny.
I know it is funny. My mother isn't the best cook who ever lived, but certainly not the worst. I don't know where this whole food thing came. And I live with someone who's a chef, or was a chef. So food is still an odd subject for me, even though. You know, I'm nowhere near as bad as I was before. But I think anyone, if you actually start focusing on food unduly, which I think was part of my problem, and you go to a restaurant and someone brings you something swimming in grease or cream sauce, and if you actually look at it, it can become grotesque. And then if you think that you're actually eating sort of animals and look at the blood on the plate. I mean, I'm still maybe betraying more of my own pathology in terms of food, but it can appear to be disgusting. My problem, though, is that the purest thing, I don't even like vegetables to this day, so...
Do you feel that there was a turning point where you, where you turned a corner and got better from the eating disorder?
Yes. after I came back to New York, I went to this sort of horrible doctor who wasn't my doctor, but I didn't have a doctor, who and at the time I was bizarrely uneducated in terms of what all of this meant. But he announced, although I had bronchitis because I smoked too much, he told me that I had pneumocystis pneumonia from having been in the office for only 10 minutes and only been wearing gloves to touch my skin. But be that as it may, at the time, for a few weeks, I thought that I had. And my first response to that was not, oh, I'm dying. It was, oh, I can't believe you never wrote a book, which I was always supposed to be doing. So I went home that night and started writing and never stopped since. But there's something galvanizing about, although in fact I did not have pneumocystis pneumonia and or any thing like that. I was in fact HIV positive. And I think within the limits of that, it was, in my particular case, a good thing, because I pulled myself together and stopped wasting my life, which I think fundamentally I'd done before then.
Who took care of you during the period when you got out of the hospital?
Well, you see, that's the I mean, you'd never know it from my books, but I have a sort of amazing family. I don't know why that isn't in my books, but they are fiction. And I, well, also unhappy families are probably more interesting than non. So when I, the reason I end up slaughtering pigs for my brother's catering business was the day I got out of the hospital, I called him from Chicago in California and said, come get me. And he hung up the phone and got in his truck and drove across country and picked up me and my dog and drove us to California and let me stay there as long as I wanted. So the further question is why then also this obsession that I have in my work about who will save you, because obviously, aside from my friends, I have a family who would.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
R.S. Jones' new novel is called Walking on Air. This is Fresh Air.